As part of this year's centennial observance of World War I, the National World War I Museum will host special event station WW1 USA. The station will be manned for 31 consecutive hours beginning Saturday at 10 in the morning. It'll run through Sunday at 5 in the afternoon. The event is free. For more information, go to theworldwar.org. For amateur radio operators, the early 1900s was an exciting time. Vacuum tube technology was revolutionizing the field, and publications like The Electrical Experimenter kept ham operators up on the latest improvements in equipment design. All that changed when the U.S. entered World War I. Here to explain how are Jonathan Casey, who is an archivist and the Edward Jones Research Center manager at the National World War I Museum. Jonathan, welcome back. Nice to have you.
Hi. Thanks, Steve.
And Herb Fittick is also here. He's an amateur radio voice of the National World War I Museum. And Herb, nice to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Jonathan, let's start with you. What happened to amateur radio operators once America declared war on Germany?
It really impacted these radio operators. The Navy was in control of radio communications. They were given control of that by President Wilson. There had been some concern even before we entered the war, when we were just a neutral, about operators using the radio, radios for transmissions that provide some information intentionally or unintentionally that they didn't want, the Navy didn't want to have go out.
That was the concern, right?
That's the concern, that they might get, not just with all the nations at war. When we were neutral, we didn't want to be seen to be really supporting one side or the other, was the idea anyway. And this wasn't just individual operators, but also radio companies like the American Marconi Company. If they were maybe seen as sending messages that weren't appropriate, that were providing information or helping one side or the other, that was an issue with the government.
So the president really shut things down.
Right. The president shut things down, starting to during those years, the first years of the war when we were neutral. But when we entered the war in April of 17, things really got shut down because they basically said to all the operators, you can't use your equipment. We don't want to take any chances of what kind of messages are going out there. Again, there might be some information intentionally or not that's given out over the airwaves that
right.
might help the other side. So,
and Herb, if someone did some transmitting back in those days, what would happen?
Well, in terms of what would happen if they did
violate
that, like today, the FCC monitors things, and I'm sure the Navy was monitoring things very closely back in those days, and they'd hunt you down. I mean, it's not hard to find the direction from that radio signals emanate from, so... I expect you'd get in big trouble.
Herb, back in the early 1900s, what did a ham operator need? And are the equipment requirements much different today from back in those days?
It's not much different. The technology obviously was a lot different in the early 1900s than it is today. And as Jonathan said, vacuum tubes were just being invented back then. So it's very crude compared to what we have today. But and there was no commercial equipment. There wasn't anybody making anything. This was all hobbyists and experimenters and people that were tinkering around in a garage.
Yeah. So Jonathan, when the government took control of virtually all radio for the duration of the war, so how was radio used in the Great War? I mean, did troops have radios in the field, or how did it work?
They had the radio telegraphs, the wireless sets that they communicated with. They also, which is kind of interesting, they had radio telephone. They actually had voice communication, wireless voice communication.
It was a huge development.
That's a huge development. And Herb just said about the vacuum tubes and all. I mean, this technology was constantly evolving before and during the war. So things, all these developments were occurring. But they had both ways of transmitting messages, and even air-to-ground or ground-to-air messages. Even they could communicate with airplanes by voice, wireless, by radio, telephone.
I'm wondering, Herb, how bulky those early sets would have been.
They were, because they were so crude, they weren't as bulky as you might expect.
Oh.
But they were, there's an example of one of those in the museum.
Were they heavy?
It's heavy. It's there was a lot of wire in those, and a lot of just the cabinet itself was made out of fine wood, and it was a cabinet making tour de force to begin with. So it was quite special, and they were not light, and they were not portable. It was an effort to carry them around.
There's this bizarre story, Jonathan, about a wealthy German living off the coast of Maine during the war. What can you tell us about that?
This was a man named Franz Hermann, who was a German who had was in the insurance business, in shipping, marine insurance. He had worked in Europe before the war and so forth, and came to the United States years before the war to do business in insurance, and he worked out in New York. But toward when we were in the war, when we were getting into it in 1917, he had bought a place in Maine in Venal Haven Island in Maine on the coast, and he was starting to put a lot of money into it. He did have money. He was a wealthy person because of his business. A lot of money was being made in shipping insurance during the war because of the threat of losses of the cargoes due to submarine attacks and whatever due to the war. So anyway, He had bought this place and put a lot of money into it. Well, he was German. There was a rising suspicions about Germans, German-Americans, and about any activity, especially along the coast, that this person, yeah. especially then Franz Hermann, might be aiding the Germans, might be aiding the enemy with a wireless station of some sort, with some communicating with submarines or ships offshore.
Yeah.
And so there was a lot of suspicion, and apparently he was... watched. He was being surveilled by federal agents. And this is the time when we were entering the war in April 17 in that first year. And there nothing, from what I've read, nothing came of that. It was just a lot of suspicion. But that was kind of a general, in a sense, kind of a not quite hysteria, but a lot of suspicions of what was going on. Because there were activities that had been happening
yeah.
during the war of espionage and sabotage and so forth.
You know, Herb, I'm wondering how amateur radio differs from radio like KCUR. And the wrong answer would be to say there's no difference, by the way, but just for the record. But how are they different?
Well, I'll give you the wrong answer. There isn't a lot of difference. The technology is very similar. You guys do it a different scale than we do in terms of power output and things like that. But amateur radio has access to a wide swath of frequencies and modes and things like that, and FM is one of them.
Yeah. Well, give us a sense, Herb, of what's happening this weekend. I mean, how did this whole thing get started?
This all started a couple of years ago and was the brainchild of a guy named Clay Wilson.
Who
passed away this summer. Yeah. And he, as part of the brainstorming that was being done at the museum, he was a longtime volunteer at the museum, very active, and also a ham radio operator. And as part of the brainstorming, he came up with the idea of having ham radio special events at various commemorations for various significant events during the war, to further the reach of the museum, to get more people aware of the museum, to be a public outreach to all around the world and all around the country. And we've been carrying on Clay's vision since then.
Okay. And what does the museum look to accomplish with this event, Jonathan? What do you see happening here?
Increased profile for the museum, reaching out to people across the country and internationally, and just telling people about us and what we are as an institution.
Just how many radio operators are part of all this, Herb?
There have been this will be our seventh event this weekend. And over those seven events, there's probably been about 200 to 250 operators from around the Kansas City area, actually as far away from Joplin and Northwest Missouri, that have been involved with it. We've made almost 7,000 contacts with other amateurs around the world in all 50 states and 95 countries.
And people still do this. Why?
Because it's fun. It is. Ham radio is actually
it's like CB radio
today,
only broader, right?
Oh yeah, much broader, and much more robust, and obviously FCC licensed, so it's a little bit more controlled. But it's a fun hobby. It is enjoying a resurgence all over the world.
You know, you hear from other radio operators from everywhere. You just said, let's take a listen to one from last year's event.
This is Whiskey 1, Uniform Sierra Alpha. This is a special event. We're operating from the National World War I Museum in Kansas City, Missouri, to commemorate the Christmas truce during World War I in 1914.
Whiskey Delta Zero Alpha Kilo X-ray.
The Alpha Kilo X-ray station, come again?
Yeah, good afternoon. It's Whiskey Delta Zero Alpha Kilo X-ray. The name is Larry, Lima Alpha Radio Yankee in Albert Lee, Minnesota. Over.
Roger, Larry. This is Whiskey 1, Uniform Sierra Alpha. The name here is John, Juliet Oscar Hotel, November. You are solid 5-9 copy. You've got a great signal in the Kansas City today.
Herb, we're talking about a really robust sort of network out in the world still to this day, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that was an operator that was in Minnesota that happened to record our exchange there. But as I said, we've contacted folks in 95 different countries.
So people, if they come down to the museum this week, and they're going to hear transmissions from all over the world then?
Yep, just like that one that you just heard.
And is it all in English, or how does it work?
It is all in English. That's kind of just like in aeronautical circles, the universal language of ham radio is English.
I bet you come across some really interesting people. Like who, Herb?
We do. We've made, you know, the cool thing about ham radio is you never know who you're gonna contact. If you, as you put out the call to for people to call you, you never know who you're gonna get back. It's like fishing. You throw a hook in the water and you never know what you're gonna catch. And it's always fun to look those folks up on the internet and figure out where they're from and what their background is. And you find places from a geography standpoint that you didn't even know existed.
Yeah. How big is ham radio today?
Ham radio is huge. It is. There are about 750,000 amateur radio operators in the U.S. I don't know what the global numbers are, but it is enjoying a resurgence, and it's more popular today than it's ever been.
And people who show up this weekend to participate, Jonathan, what can they expect? What are they going to see?
The operations, how it works. I mean, just there's several things going on this weekend, actually, at the museum, and the Living History group is going to be there. But they're going to be able to see Herb and his colleagues and all, and what they do with the radio, but the Living History and there's some other events that are happening, and it's just the museum itself, of course.
Well, special event station WW1 USA will be manned at the National World War I Museum from Saturday at 10 through Sunday at 5. The event is free. More information, go to theworldwar.org. And I want to thank Jonathan Casey, an archivist with the World War I Museum, and Herb Fiddick, who is the amateur radio voice of the National World War I Museum. Thank you both very much. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.